You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did George W. Bush, the man, become George W. Bush, the president of the United States? And how have his most important relationships influenced the way he's run the country for the past 8 years? After spending the early part of his life dwarfed by his famous family's reputation, George W. Bush found apparent comfort in neoconservatives who considered George H.W. Bush's presidency a failure. And he grew ever more attracted to political positions that managed to be, as my guest today has joked, opposite of both the first President Bush's and of President Bill Clinton's. But how did a man without long-held ideological convictions grow, for a time at least, to be such a hero to U.S. conservatives? And will he be able to restore his reputation, if not his legacy, with whatever he chooses to do when he leaves the White House? Jacob Weisberg is here to talk about George W. Bush, his presidency, and the presidency that will follow his. He is editor-in-chief of the Slate Group of online magazines and the author of several books of Bushisms, quotations of Mr. Bush's sometimes inept use of language. His new book is a serious study of the president's life and influences. It's called The Bush Tragedy, and it has just been released in paperback. Jacob, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
So George W. Bush was a guy who grew up and came of age, certainly, under his father's shadow, and essentially tried to do everything that his dad had done, but didn't quite have the same success.
He did, and it's a poignant story when you see it in that context. His father was a star on the baseball team at Andover and at Yale, was a war hero, the youngest pilot in the United States Navy, a very good student. Of success at a very young age in business. He went to Texas, he struck oil, he built a company, expanded it, and then was obviously a huge success in politics. And George H.W. Bush loomed as a huge figure in the whole extended family. He was really the sort of chosen one. The family's whole hopes were really deposited in him. And I think growing up as the oldest son and namesake of that man had to have been very difficult. And you see in his the whole first part of his life, George W., trying to do all of those things that his father did so well and so gracefully, and doing them very unsuccessfully. He was not a good athlete. He was not a good student. He didn't go into the Army. He did fly planes in the Air National Guard in Texas. He was not successful in business. He went from sort of company to company, didn't find a major oil strike, didn't build a lot of value. And then the first time he tried to run for office when he ran for Congress in 1978, he lost. And so you see this sort of building sense of frustration. And I think Bush's drinking and his unhappiness, his aggressiveness, are all really in a way expressions of that failure to be able to do what his father did.
You write about the sort of myths that the Bush family has really treasured over generations, the idea that they are self-made men and that they have, they're not wealthy, for one thing. And I'm wondering how that played into the way that the elder George Bush even responded to his son's efforts.
You know, it's funny, the Bushes do think of themselves as the anti-Kennedys, and they think of the Kennedys as being privileged, entitled, of the old man Joe Kennedy setting up his children in politics, setting up their careers, and they're contemptuous of that. And they have a real belief in the Bush family of making it on your own. Of course, making it on your own when you're a Bush is a funny thing. You have a lot of help. You have family connections. There is a lot of family money. George W. Bush was arguably, when he was born in 1946, was one of the most privileged children born in the whole country because of his family's connections on Wall Street and in Washington and their wealth and so forth. But they believe they make it on their own. So the family legend is that George H.W. Bush, after he finished college, instead of taking a comfy job on Wall Street, working at his dad's firm, which a lot of people in the family wanted him to do, got in his Studebaker and drove to Texas to start drilling for oil. And he struck oil and became a millionaire before the age of 30. And it is this sort of go west young man mythology. Now, of course, when you look at that more closely, got a job because his father, Prescott Bush, was on the board of an oil company. Family friends helped him out along the way. His uncle, George Herbert Walker, was the main investor in his business when he started out. He had that path was paved for him by a lot of family connection. But at the same time, if you go in the George Bush Presidential Library at College Station, you see a replica of that Studebaker. It's the first thing you see when you walk in. That's how the Bushes think of themselves. And George W. Bush, when he decided to set himself up in business after finishing business school at Harvard, really recreated that journey. He had a different car. It wasn't a Studebaker. It was a Cutlass. But he got in his car and he drove right back to Midland, Texas, where his father went. Now, he'd grown up there, so there was some irony to sort of repeating his father's steps so literally. But that's how they think of it. And actually, it was Jeb who I think followed the family script more successfully, because he went somewhere different. Instead of going back to Texas, he went to Florida, set himself up in the real estate business there, went into politics, and, you know, again, availed himself of a lot of connections the Bush family had. At the same time, did in some sense make it on his own.
Was Jeb Bush the one that the family really expected to rise in politics?
Well, this is played up very strongly in Oliver Stone's movie. I don't know if you've seen
haven't
that.
Haven't seen it yet.
Some people listening surely have, although others probably have not. But yes, I think there was. I think that's more true than not. I think there was a sense in which the family came to focus on Jeb as the political leader of the family in their generation. And I think it was partly because of George W.'s failures, because of his drinking, because of his failure to kind of do anything successful in his own life until he was 40, but also because of Jeb's precociousness about business and politics and just his general seriousness about life. And, you know, Jeb made money. He started his family much sooner. He became Secretary of Commerce in Florida, and I think the parents really thought that he was going to be the one to lead the family. They also think he was, you know, people in the family think he was smarter. They think he's more capable. They all like George W. better, which is sort of the irony of it. George is the even in the family, he's the one you want to have a beer with. Jeb is regarded as a little stuffy, a little serious, a little dull. But at the same time, I think the parents and a lot of people in the family thought he was the natural leader.
What influence did Barbara Bush and growing up with an often depressed Barbara Bush, what influence did that have on the kind of man that George W. Bush became?
Well, it's interesting, and it's hard, again, here to sort of separate the reality based on what we know from a lot of the mythology that various members of the family have created about this. George W. has laid up the idea that he's his mother's son, I think in part to distance himself from his father. When he was first running, you know, he didn't, because he was trying to create a more conservative political profile, he really didn't want to be associated with his father's views. And of course, there is all the anxiety we were talking about earlier about being the son of this man. So he really took to the idea that he was his mother's son. And certainly there are qualities they have in common. But they both have a caustic wit. They both have a hard edge. They're both quick. They're both very aggressive. They can both be very nasty. But at the same time, I think that may be overdrawn a little. I think George W. was at times growing up very much at odds with both his parents, and I think his mother has been in many ways much harder on his failings than his father has. But it is true, I think his father was really an absent figure, a well-meaning figure when he was growing up, but he was traveling a lot, first in building his oil business and then once his political career started. And George W. was at home a lot with his mom, who was depressed, and especially after his younger sister Robin died of leukemia when he was a little boy, I think she went into a very deep depression, and he was really forced to become the adult, the man in the family, because his father wasn't there. They were dealing with it in part through sort of denial, and I think that solidified a bond with his mom and also at least a kind of latent antagonism to his father.
How did the neocons sort of discover George W. Bush as someone that they could influence and really sort of make into the candidate that they hoped to have in the White House?
Well, it's interesting, you know, when George W. was governor of Texas, he really he was a pretty moderate governor. I mean, as you know, he had a lot of Democratic support. He won with significant proportions of the Latino vote in Texas, even of the African American vote, And nobody would have thought of him as a neoconservative during his first term as governor. But when he was elected the second time and he and Karl Rove began to focus on his presidential campaign, he needed a profile in foreign affairs. He needed to understand foreign affairs, which he had no background in whatsoever. And they started to bring in people to talk to him. And two of the most influential people were Dick Cheney, who was there as CEO of Halliburton, and also Condi Rice, who he had met and liked and fastened on to. Neither of them at that point would have been called a neoconservative. I'm not sure even now that you can accurately describe either of them as a neoconservative. But a lot of the people they brought to tutor Bush in foreign policy did have what we'd call a neoconservative perspective. They included Paul Wolfowitz and some of the other people who surfaced at the Defense Department after Bush became president. But I think what he was looking for really was a foreign policy that he could associate with Ronald Reagan's and that was the opposite in many ways of his dad's. And I think as on so many issues, his starting point in foreign policy was that his dad was wrong and Reagan was right. And he knew that he sort of accepted the neoconservative critique of his father's foreign policy, that the 41, his dad had been too accommodating toward the Soviet Union in its closing days. You know, whereas Reagan said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," his father hadn't even made a speech when the Berlin Wall came down. He hadn't wanted to inflame the situation. And the biggest part of that neoconservative Reaganite critique of George H.W. Bush was that he had left Saddam in power in Iraq. So I think that there was a lot that was aligned as George W. developed his view of the world, his foreign policy view. I think what the neoconservatives had to say really spoke to him. It spoke to him personally because it involved the repudiation of what his dad stood for. But also I think it spoke to his tendency to look at the world in very black and white and relatively simple moral terms.
Did Dick Cheney view the term of the first President Bush, who he worked for, as a failure?
I think Cheney's role in all of this is so interesting, but inevitably involves speculation because he is so discreet and so secretive that, you know, what he thought at any given point is a little hard to say. I think Cheney played his relationship with his father very, very effectively in relation to the son. So one thing is that George W. may criticize his father very harshly and would do so very openly and talk about his father's failed presidency. But he wouldn't want to hear any outsider, including even Karl Rove, someone as close to him as that, do that. So I think Cheney, you know, had some personal loyalty to the 41, knew better than to be openly critical of 41 when talking to 43. At the same time, I think he really made clear to George W. when he was running that he was going to be his man and not his father's man, and that he wasn't a member of 41's inner circle the way Brent Scowcroft was or James Baker was, and that he really would become part of the son's team. And even more than that, I think he sort of was able to kind of play on the psychology in terms of how he presented a lot of issues to George W.
Jacob Weisberg's latest book is called The Bush Tragedy. He is editor-in-chief of the Slate Group of online magazines. We'll return to our discussion in just a moment and would love to have you join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email us. That goes to think@kera.org. Listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jacob Weisberg. He is editor-in-chief of the Slate Group. His book is called The Bush Tragedy. It's just been re-released in paperback. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Dick Cheney is a very interesting figure in this book. His detractors will claim that he is greedy. They will say that he is someone who cares only about collecting power for himself. But in fact, here he really comes across as someone who supports his ideas about the way that power should be distributed in the federal government, often to his own detriment.
Yeah, well, I do think Dick Cheney is about ideas. He was a trained political scientist before he went into politics. He's people who have observed him in the White House, worked with him, will say that he's the best prepared person in any meeting. He's one of the smartest people they've ever worked with. And I think we shouldn't have been as surprised by Dick Cheney, because he had actually been quite open about his view of the world. And I think we didn't pay much attention to it before, even when he was running for vice president. We didn't pay attention to it until it was too late, in a way. But Dick Cheney had a very consistent, very clear, and very well-argued view that the American executive isn't powerful enough. And during the Cold War, he argued that it wasn't powerful enough to confront the threat from the Soviet Union. And after that ended, and after September 11th, he somewhat seamlessly took up the view that it wasn't powerful enough to confront the security threats from terrorism. And he's been totally open about this, but he's been open about it in think tank papers and speeches he's given. And it didn't the balance of power between the executive and legislative branches didn't seem very interesting to people before the Bush presidency. But I think you have to, I think Dick Cheney's wrong about a lot of this in substance, but I think you have to give him credit for making serious arguments, for taking views seriously, and I don't think it is in any way about ego or self-aggrandizement or his own power, or even the particular power of this president. I think he thinks the presidency should be more powerful, and he has done everything he can over decades, even when he was himself in the legislative branch, to advance that cause.
Does Cheney seem to care much about his own legacy or that of President Bush?
I think Cheney, well, I would separate those two things. But in terms of his own legacy, no, I think he really doesn't. I think Cheney, part of the reason Cheney has been so effective is he really is someone who sublimates his own ego. He doesn't care about his image. He doesn't care what the press thinks about him. He doesn't care about how well-liked he is. He really is about accomplishing his goals, about getting his moving his views forward. And I think, you know, you always hear about this mythical creature in Washington who is successful because he doesn't care who gets the credit as long as the result comes out the way he wants. Dick Cheney's actually that person. You know, he's very low-key. He doesn't care about his image. He doesn't see himself as a politician. But again, to some extent, you know, we thought those were, I think people would have said those were positive qualities before he entered the administration. You would think, well, the guy doesn't have an ego. He doesn't care about his press clippings. He doesn't want to be president himself. But that's part of a political accountability, at least the part about having some political ambitions and having a vice president who doesn't aspire to anything higher. In a way, creates a danger because there's no feedback mechanism. If someone isn't paying attention to what the press says and they don't care about their approval rating, they don't care what people think, in a way they can be much more dangerous. And I think Dick Cheney was an example of that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Jacob Weisberg. His book is called The Bush Tragedy. We have John on the line in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi. I'm surprised at how few people I've heard actually talk about this on talk shows and stuff. But is it possible that because Saddam Hussein had made an assassination attempt on W. Bush's father, that it was just too personal for him to look at in a, you know, dispassionate way? And what would have happened if somebody on his, you know, somebody in his cabinet had said to him, say, look, Mr. President, is this just a personal vendetta, getting even with Saddam? Because, you know, is this the family using the United States Army to carry out a family vendetta? And of course, you'd probably be fired if you phrased it that way. I'm sure that'd be treading on thin ice. But is it possible that he let his passions get the better of him in that situation.
Well, it's safe. I think it's safe to say that that no one in the White House would have felt comfortable making that point to him if they believed it. I think that would be there would be no surer way to get him to turn purple and explode. I think that the personal animosity between the Bush families and the Hussein families was one of the contributing factors here. I think there was it helped create a disposition whereby Bush was very receptive to arguments that we should invade Iraq after September 11th. But that said, absent September 11th, I don't think it necessarily would have happened. There's still a lot of mystery about this. You know, we don't really know when Bush made the decision to go to war with Iraq. We don't know where he was when he made it. We don't know who was in the room. It's not even clear that he made the decision at a specific time as opposed to just evolving into it. And part of that was I think he thought there were so many good reasons for going to war with Iraq, including the fact, personally, that they had tried to assassinate members of his family, not just his father, but his wife and his brother and his sister. He thought there were a lot of good reasons. One of the ironies of this, of course, is that subsequently the evidence that there was an assassination attempt in Kuwait against his father during the Clinton years, which Bill Clinton believed too and retaliated against, that evidence has gotten pretty sketchy. The Kuwaitis commuted the sentences of the people who were supposedly plotting a coup and an attack against former President Bush. And there was a long article in The New Yorker that made a pretty powerful case that there may not have been an assassination attempt at all.
Do you think Bush is bothered by the fact that the Republican nominee, who is John McCain, has done everything but absolutely avoid contact with the president and really has done everything he can to separate himself from the current White House?
What's funny, I just saw a quote from him. They asked him that, and he said, "I understand that. I had to distance myself from my own father when I was running for president," which is ironic in a number of ways, because I think his readiness to distance himself from his father was not purely political. I think it was, in fact, part and parcel of what he was trying to do in politics and personally. But I don't think he is particularly upset by that. I mean, for one thing, there's never been any real affinity between McCain and Bush. I don't think they've ever liked each other. Bush understands that if McCain were to be elected, it would be helpful in terms of his legacy. It would be a kind of vindication. So he certainly wants McCain to win, but I don't think it hurts his feelings. Bush is in a funny mindset in this sort of last part of his presidency. He seems to take all the hostility directed at him, his extreme unpopularity. He's the most unpopular president since we've been doing polling on this. He seems to take it as a kind of vindication, and he very much believes that historians will, down the road, will start to see him for the great president he believes he was, and it'll all come around, and he tries to affect this attitude that he's sort of philosophical about that. It's out of his control, but he thinks it'll happen when it happens. I think that's much less likely than he does in terms of the historical revisionism. At the same time, I don't think he sort of gets hurt by people lashing out at him. In fact, I think he takes it as a sign, evidence that he's right.
In what capacity do you expect that he will be politically active once he is a former president?
Well, as I understand it, he's coming back to your town, and he's building a big home there, and he wants to set up this institute. I mean, he's going to build his presidential library at SMU, but he also wants to build, as part of that, what he's described as a freedom institute or some sort of institute for the promotion of democracy internationally, which, of course, has been a big cause of his in the second term and was the subject of his second inaugural address, which was one of his most important speeches. So I think he sees himself doing that. At the same time, I don't think he's going to be a former president of the Clinton-Carter type who spends a lot of time getting involved in things, going around the world. I think he's going to fight for his legacy, too, in the way they both have, but in a much quieter way, and that he's probably going to take his leisure a little more as a former president and step back from really active kind of engagement in global affairs.
Do you know anything about the relationship that must have developed to some extent between the first President Bush and Bill Clinton when they were traveling around the world together?
Well, that was the subject of a lot of jokes. You know, I mean, they certainly the family, you know, after Clinton won in 92, the Bush family just hated the Clintons. I mean, they just thought they were low-class people and just untrustworthy, and it was very personal. They took that defeat very personally. I don't think it was reciprocated. I don't think the Clintons had any particular hostility towards the Bush family. But then, you know, after former Presidents Clinton and Bush got together to work on relief for the tsunami, they did seem to form an affinity and a bond, and it became kind of a joke, and there's been sort of uncomfortable jokes back and forth. You know, this George W. little joke that, you know, his Clinton's the son his father wished he had. And, you know, they all go at it in various ways. No, you know, so it's hard to get a sense what those relationships are really like. I don't think there's any real closeness between former Presidents Clinton and Bush. I think it's more in the nature of an effective alliance on a few issues where they both share a point of view.
You've written some interesting things assessing how religion and faith really have shaped George W. Bush. And I wonder if you would talk about those and then sort of apply that to how religious we might imagine any president to be openly in the future as compared with George W. Bush.
When I started the book, Chris, I wanted to understand who Bush was and what he thought. I thought that would be the key to why he'd made the decisions he'd made. And I thought the key to what he thought had to be in his religious beliefs, which were obviously very important to him, something he took very seriously. And I read everything I could about it, studied it. I went to Midland. I went to his Bible study group. I really tried to understand his religious view. And I came up so empty-handed that I couldn't figure it out. There just didn't seem to be any substance to his religious views at all. And when he'd talk about it, even privately, what he would be arguing for was religion itself, and it didn't seem to even matter particularly what religion it was. He thinks that faith is good for people, and it's good for people because it can help them change their lives the way he changed his life. And being some kind of born-again Christian was clearly crucial to him in his pulling his life together when he had this midlife crisis around the age of 40, when he stopped drinking and put his career on the right track and kept his family together. And he thought belief in God was crucial to all of that. And he wanted other people to have that experience. But beyond that, it didn't seem to matter much what they believed. And there's no particular theology to his religion at all. And that's the thing I found very, very surprising. Also, his religion, I think, is sincere and genuine at one level, but it is extremely political, and he has used it very, very politically in the way he's related to the evangelical movement and to specific ministers and evangelical groups from the time he first ran in Texas. And this is a subject that George W. Bush probably, more than any other, is an expert on, is politics of the evangelical movement in the United States.
Well, I guess it's easier to endear oneself to a large segment of the population who might actually believe different things in terms of doctrine if you don't elucidate exactly what it is that you believe.
But you assume that there's something he believes and that he's holding it back, and I'm not so sure. I mean, I think he believes in God, and I think he believes that Jesus Christ is his Savior, and at that level, I think it's sincere. But beyond that, I'm not sure there is any particular substance to his religious beliefs.
He is a voracious reader, and there are a lot of interesting things that he chooses to read about. Can you talk about what's in his library?
It is interesting. That's another surprise about him. He is a reader, and people assume not. I don't think he has very good retention of a lot of what he reads, but I think he spends a lot of time reading. In fact, I think it's probably his main activity. He doesn't have much social life in Washington. He doesn't go out. I mean, basically, he exercises, he watches sports on TV, and he reads. And he reads a lot of history. I mean, he reads some for entertainment. You know, he'll read kind of thrillers or popular novels. But a lot of what he reads is political history. And in particular, he seems to focus on figures who he identifies with.
Truman, Churchill,
Teddy Roosevelt. And the Truman example is particularly interesting because he sees Truman as the big example for him after he leaves, because Truman was a very unpopular president and left office with really the country being sick to death, much like people are about Bush now. But over time, the historical view of him evolved and was revised, and now Truman is regarded by mainstream American historians as a very good, maybe even a great president. And the argument is that he framed the fundamental doctrines and institutions of the Cold War. So Bush sees a strong analogy there. He thinks that he's unpopular now, but historians will come to see that he framed the fundamental doctrines and institutions of the War on Terror, and that this was his historical role.
Is it possible that might have happened, assuming that the war in Iraq is ultimately resolved in a way that the United States views as favorable, that might have happened were it not for the financial crisis that will be the sort of last gong that reverberates when people think about the Bush administration?
You're saying, would it be possible, based on the improvement in Iraq, for his reputation to improve?
To 50 years down the line, for people to look at him and say there were things he did that ultimately made sense?
I think that would have been hard anyway, because I don't think the decision to invade Iraq I don't think it's really possible for that decision to be vindicated. I mean, even if things continue to improve, and you know, let's hope they do, but even if Iraq stabilizes more and the United States is able to withdraw, the decision was still based on false information. And if we'd known the truth, we never would have gone in. I'm not sure that the biggest decision of his presidency can be vindicated.
Jacob Weisberg is my guest. His newest book is called The Bush Tragedy. We'll return to our discussion in a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jacob Weisberg, who is editor-in-chief of the Slate Group of online magazines. His latest book is called The Bush Tragedy. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Mark in Dallas. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Chris. Jacob, I just saw the Stone film, and was moved on a bunch of different levels. I mean, on one hand, what a country we live in that someone, an artist, can make a film about a sitting president or write a book that tells the story the way he did and not get thrown in jail or worse. I'm wondering what your reaction was to the film. And I also want to say that Dallas Morning News reporter Wayne Slater, who spent years with Bush in Austin at the governor's mansion, wrote about that film and said that Stone nailed it, that he absolutely got George Bush on film, and that this is a very accurate piece. And in fact, a lot of the dialogue is verbatim from transcripts. What do you think?
Thanks for the question. We had in Slate, which is the my magazine, had a dialogue that I did with Stone. And also with Bob Woodward and Ron Susskind, two other people who have written a lot of books about Bush. And we had a really interesting discussion that ran all last week in Slate. So I would recommend you look that up, just because there are a lot of interesting issues. And there are things I liked about the film and things I didn't like about it. I would certainly second your first comment is, thank God we live in a country where you can do that. I think it was... it was gutsy of Stone to try to do it, because aside from the issue of the First Amendment, it's very difficult to portray people dramatically who are so familiar to the audience. And I just think it's sort of very, very tough. And I think parts of the characterization and portrayal of several of the characters, and especially of Bush, were very, very good. I think Josh Brolin really. He doesn't look a whole lot like Bush, but there are things about his manner that he really gets down. And Stone did use a lot of real material, although he transposed a lot of it in a way that was sort of odd, where something Bush said in one place, you know, is he has him saying 10 years later in a different context, which was a little weird. The thing I objected to much, the thing I objected to most in the film was the sort of conspiratorial view, you know, which is something that Stone seems unable to stay away from. And there's one kind of pivotal scene in the film, which is an 11-minute long scene where they're in the White House Situation Room, and Stone sets this up as sort of his case for sort of why Bush went to war, and he has everybody, all the principals, Cheney and Rumsfeld and Powell and Rice, all kind of saying their parts, and he has Cheney kind of get up and give the pivotal bit of this case and saying, essentially, we've got to go get their oil, and, you know, we're running out of oil, and we won't be able to maintain the American empire unless we get theirs, and in fact, cornering Iraq's oil is only a prelude for going after the real prize, which is Iran. And they've really got the mother load of oil. And, you know, this is just unsupported in any way. I mean, it's not, one, there was no meeting like that. Two, those are not, you know, things Cheney has said. I don't think they're things he thinks in any way. And, you know, kind of putting this, framing this as Bush, you know, buying into this argument about creating an American empire in the Middle East, I think, is a sort of left-wing fantasy about what happened. So I object to that pretty strenuously. But then again, I thought there were things about the film and the characterizations that were really very good.
I have to tell you, Jacob, I've been as much a fan of the Bushisms of the day and of the books as the next person. I have to wonder, though, if you ever wonder whether they're sort of a mischaracterization that frame our assessment of George W. Bush in a way that is that starts with something that's maybe not an accurate reflection of his intelligence.
Yeah, I think the Bushisms do create a sort of misimpression of Bush. I mean, they contribute to the misunderestimation of him, as he would say. They make him sound stupid, they make him sound stupid in a way he definitely isn't. I mean, he isn't. Low-witted. He isn't a fool. You know, they do make him sound that way. Now, I think the context of them changed a lot. I mean, when I started collecting the Bushisms during his first campaign, they were really, in a way, good fun. And Bush was in on the joke. I mean, the first press dinner he did in Washington after he was elected, he held up the book and read from it. And, you know, he really... you know, he can laugh at himself, which is one of his good qualities. But I think, you know, as the presidency became more polarizing, the Bushisms took on more and more the character of a kind of hostile act, and they stopped being funny to people who liked Bush, and people who didn't like Bush took them to mean more than they should have been taken to mean. So I'm willing to accept some responsibility for contributing to that misimpression. On the other hand, I do think that, you know, the project was always sort of intended to be more for amusement purposes than political purposes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Jacob Weisberg is here. Let's go next to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I had two questions. One was from what I've heard so far, I don't understand the title, the tragedy part of it, and the second question was, did he ever blame his father for having gotten him or let Iraq invade Kuwait and have that whole thing even take place in the first place? And I'll just listen to you. Thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, on the second one, I don't think he blamed his father for letting Iraq invade Kuwait, but I do think he thought he made the wrong decision in leaving Saddam in power and not finishing the job. I think he bought into that part of the criticism of his dad. In terms of the tragedy, you know, I think it's a tragedy at multiple levels. I mean, I think the Bush tragedy has been a tragedy for the country. I think it's been a tragedy for the world. But I also think there's a dimension of family tragedy and personal tragedy that this man, driven by these sort of demons, was propelled into this position of power, which he really wasn't suited to, really wasn't capable of maintaining. And I talk in the book about this an analogy to the Shakespeare plays, the sort of Henry IV, Henry V sequence, which is really sort of an amazing analogy. I mean, Prince Hal, who becomes Henry V, is in the play Henry IV, this dissolute, dissipated young man who's drinking and out pranking with his friend Falstaff, and you know, has just basically nobody understands how he's going to inherit the throne from this very wise and distinguished father of his, Henry IV. And then he all of a sudden transforms himself, and he finds God and becomes religious. He quits drinking, becomes very serious about life, and he, when he becomes Henry V, he becomes this very different person all of a sudden, and is the most, actually, most religious and most military of Shakespeare's English kings. So it's a sort of fascinating story, and it's the Henry plays are histories in according to the Shakespearean classification, but it's also a tragedy in many senses. One, because of the way the son pushes the dying father aside in a way the father doesn't much like, but also because you can read it as the plays as an argument that the son's weaknesses actually won out in the end. Although Henry V is a heroic figure in Shakespeare, the Hundred Years' War did not end up working out so well for England. England was overextended and couldn't afford to pay for them and couldn't rule France and ended up having to withdraw after a great loss. So you know, I think the analogy and the notion of Shakespearean tragedy at work in this family is really kind of parallel.
I wonder if I can switch topics here for the last few minutes and talk about the atmosphere around the offices of a place like Slate Magazine on the eve of an election that is this big, that so many people feel very deeply invested in. Do your reporters go in with sort of an assumption based on the polls about what they'll be covering for Wednesday morning? How do you strategize?
Well, one thing, Slate does approach these things a little differently. For one thing, we all like to lay our cards on the table in terms of our own views. And for the last several elections, we've done a survey, which is voluntary, but we ask everybody on staff who they're voting for. And now our lead political reporter, John Dickerson, who's very fair and scrupulous, didn't vote, didn't say who he's voting for. I don't know if he's voting for anybody. But the rest of the people on staff, and this includes our copy editors and the people on our business side, were overwhelmingly for Obama. We had one person who was for McCain and one person who was for the Libertarian candidate and, you know, several people who weren't voting, but overwhelmingly for Obama. So it's pretty clear who state, although we don't make an endorsement, pretty clear who Slate collectively by consensus would like to win. We're much more in the business of analysis, commentary, explanation. We do have a full-time political reporter out on the trail, but we're not so worried about making the wrong decision about who to cover. It's really a question for us of trying to come up with something original and interesting to say.
So it's a matter of the questions about what this all means, regardless of what the answer is on Wednesday morning.
Yeah, I think that's right. But, you know, we have a piece up today, again, by our John Dickerson, who's our lead political writer, saying, boy, is the press going to have a lot of egg on his face if McCain wins. And he doesn't completely discount the possibility. I mean, I don't think he's betting against Obama, but at the same time, he's sort of noting how invested in many ways the press, including us, would be fair to say, has become in an Obama victory, and how conclusively we've predicted it. I mean, you leave yourself a little wiggle room, but I think it's fair to say that people at Slate are really betting on McCain losing tomorrow.
One thing that Slate does that, as far as I can tell, everything that's ever been on the site is sort of searchable forever, and it exists forever. Has that changed the way journalists approach their work, knowing that this is not something that gets printed in a newspaper and will likely be thrown away by the vast majority of people who read it, never to be seen again?
Well, it's funny. It was a big change in journalism, you know, some years ago, maybe around the time we started, when, thanks to the combination of online databases like LexisNexis and online publications like ours and Google, but nothing you write is ever forgotten. You know, you're, there's much more sense that your mistakes will be around, so you can be reminded of them until your dying day. So I do think, in that sense, people are writing a little more for the ages. But it's also true in publications like Slate. It's some of it is more ephemeral. Some of it's the opposite, because we're writing. It's a constant medium, and in some respects, it's more like conversation or more like email then it is like writing a long considered piece, and it has a more conversational tone. So I don't think the weight of the eternal searchability bears too heavily on people's minds when they're writing. I think we're thinking more about what you can say that would be interesting and fresh that day.
Do you think that the next presidency, whether it's an Obama presidency or a McCain presidency, will be more of a deliberate foil to the one that's come before than other administrations have been in the past, even presidents who have followed so-called failed presidencies?
You know, it's one of the things I've learned from watching the Bush presidencies, how much they can come to define themselves in opposition. I think this President Bush has defined himself both in opposition to his father and to Clinton's presidency. And the explanation for so many decisions he made was that he found a way to do something that was the opposite of both Clinton's dad, and, you know, harking back to Reagan. Here, I think that will be a factor. I think even if McCain wins, not as much as if Obama wins, but he will be looking to create distance between himself and Bush to define himself in opposition. And I have to say, I think it's a very unhealthy tendency. I think a presidency should start fresh and look at issues afresh and not assume that because you disagreed with the guy who came before that the right answer is the opposite of what he did.
Does our insatiable hunger for change right now at this moment in our country's history sort of set the next president up to fail? Because none of the problems that we have right now can be quickly or easily solved, most of them not even in a single term.
Well, you could argue that the president is what the British call a poison chalice that way, that you sort of can't win. You're inheriting such a terrible situation in Iraq and in Afghanistan with the economy that, you know, there'll be, if Obama's elected, he'll come in with this enormous projected budget deficit and essentially be stymied in all the kinds of plans he had for health care reform and everything else. I think there's some truth to that. On the other hand, expectations are appropriately extremely low right now, and who's ever elected will have 4 years to turn things around before he has to stand for election again. And this could be a very deep and very bad recession. I think a lot of signs point to that, but it's extremely unlikely to be a recession that lasts 4 years. So I think we're likely to have come out of this economy. And, you know, Reagan took a very bad recession in 81, 82 after he was elected. But by 84, the economy was booming, and he was reelected with record numbers.
Jacob Weisberg is editor-in-chief of the Slate Group of online magazines. His book, The Bush Tragedy, has just been re-released in paperback. Jacob, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks, Chris. Pleasure talking to you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.